This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We turn now to part two in our series on the price of power. Yesterday, we talked about what needs to be done to improve the nation's electrical power grid. Today, we'll focus on alternative sources of energy. Last week's big blackout has sparked new interest in the possibilities of wind, solar, and nuclear power, fuel cells, and localized electrical generation, often called microgrids or power parks. They all touch on vital issues, including less reliance on the grid, on clean air, and, given our reliance on imported oil, on national security. If you have experience with alternative sources of power, say owning a solar house or a hydroelectric car, tell us why you went that route and what it's been like. And what about your energy awareness? Do you think about where electricity comes from? Maybe you do know after last week's outage. Do you take steps to reduce your consumption of energy, from buying low-flow shower heads and low-flush toilets to turning down your thermostat in the winter? You can also call us with your questions about this technology, of the competitiveness and the prospects of alternative technologies. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Severin Borenstein, director of the Energy Institute and professor at the Haas School of Business, both at the University of California at Berkeley. He's with us from the studios there on the Berkeley campus. And good of you to be back with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we talk about these alternatives, it seems we should talk right up front about the energy conservation, the elephant in the room, and energy efficiency. Is there progress on this front, or are people using, as we seem to be reading, more energy per person than ever?
Well, both of those statements are true. There's been a lot of progress in energy efficiency over the last 10 or 20 years. Many of the appliances in our homes have become vastly more energy efficient. At the same time, the economy has been growing and the population's been growing, and people are consuming more energy, and electricity consumption year by year is still growing. Now, it's obviously growing much less quickly than it would have if we didn't make these sorts of progress in energy efficiency.
Mm-hmm. What about the costs associated with that? People are very price sensitive, aren't they, when it comes to big ticket items like washing machines and refrigerators? Don't we always consider the benefits of that immediate price tag as opposed to the long-term benefits?
Well, for the typical household consumer, a lot of studies have indicated that people don't adequately consider the long-term savings. And as a result, the federal government has moved towards labeling on refrigerators and washers and so forth that tries to give people an idea of how much money they would save by using a more energy-efficient technology. That has made some progress. There have also been increasing standards over the year, making it required that a refrigerator, for instance, doesn't use more than a certain amount of energy. But it's pretty clear that left to their own devices, most consumers are focused more on the big-ticket price tag and don't really consider as much how much additional electricity they might have to use over the years of use of whatever appliance they're buying.
Let's talk about now each of the major sources of renewable energy and discuss their benefits and drawbacks and costs. And obviously, we could go hours on each of the one of them, so let's try go quickly. And start with solar. Is the technology of solar energy improving?
The technology is clearly improving, but unfortunately, it's still a long ways from being cost competitive with the fossil fuel generation that is really the basic source of our electricity. The solar panels, photovoltaic panels, have come down in cost quite a bit, but typically they're still four times as much or more than fossil fuel generation. The technology continues to improve. This is one of the areas where I think it's clear that we need to continue to do a lot of research and development to try to improve the technology. But what the governments, both federal and many state governments, are doing right now is subsidizing massively the use of current technologies. And the current technologies just aren't cost effective. We're going to, I'm sure, have some callers who will tell us that they have put in solar panels and they're saving money. But in almost all of those cases, they're getting big subsidies from the federal government through a tax break or through their state governments.
Some of them might point out that the other more conventional fuels, oil, natural gas, they may have gotten a tax break or two along the way themselves.
That's right. There are some subsidies for some of these fuels, but when we look at, for instance, the world price of oil, that isn't being driven by U.S. tax subsidies. That is a world price that's reflective of all the production in the world. Also in natural gas markets, although they tend to be more continental, not worldwide, there is a pretty competitive market out there. Now, there are some important policy issues about how much of the North American continent is going to be open to gas drilling, and that certainly will drive the price.
Here's an email question on solar power from Bruce DeGroff. The energy required to produce a solar panel is greater than the energy that will ever be produced by that panel. So, true or false, he asks.
Oh, I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't know. It certainly, the production of solar panels have become much more efficient, but it does take quite a bit of energy, but I think that on net they still are net producers of energy. There actually are some interesting environmental issues associated with solar panels, since some of the contents of the panels themselves can be hazardous waste. Unfortunately, it turns out that none of these sources that we think of as environmentally benign turn out to be completely environmentally benign.
Which brings us to wind power. This is burgeoning, and as I understand it, this is becoming more cost competitive.
Yes, and wind power is probably the closest to cost competitive of any of the alternative energy sources. It's still not quite there. The technology, again, is making big leaps and is improving every year, and I think is close. And in some situations, it can be nearly cost effective to use wind power. If we actually took into account the environmental costs of using fossil fuels, particularly coal, we probably would see that wind power is a pretty good technology. At this point, coal producers do have to make some investments to offset their pollution, but they're still net polluters of the air, and wind tends to be a pretty environmentally benign technology. As I say that, I know someone will call in and point out that they can kill birds, and that's true. And right now there's a big controversy off Cape Cod where some people have proposed building a wind farm a mile off Cape Cod, and people who live on the Cape are objecting that there will be visual pollution because they'll have to look at these windmills.
In fact, veteran newsman Walter Cronkite has lent his name and voice to an effort to keep that wind farm out of Nantucket Sound.
Experts have warned that these massive wind turbines could disrupt the natural habitat for wildlife in the Sound and endanger boats and airplanes. Renewable energy is, of course, important, and we should promote its appropriate development. But our national treasures should be off limits to industrialization, and Nantucket Sound is one of those treasures.
And not to focus just on the waters off Cape Cod, this is an issue in places like Minnesota and Palmdale, California. Everywhere they're talking about building some of these big wind turbine windmills.
That's absolutely right. Wherever they have gotten into building large wind farms, there has been a not-in-my-backyard response, the people who don't want to have them in their neighborhood.
Let's get a caller on the line. Seth joins us from Oberlin, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling just to follow up on one of the comments your speaker said, which was about the environmental costs, and I guess in economic terms you would call it an externality, where a certain cost of a fuel is not accounted for in the price at the pump, say. And if we begin to add these into the cost of coal and oil and our standard fuels, I would think that the renewable energies would begin to look very affordable in comparison. Some examples would be not only the health of the air and water, but also respiratory disease in the general population, the perhaps unaccountable cost of global warming, the cost of keeping a standing army to fight wars to ensure our oil supply. If all of these things are then factored into our current energy system, I think that our current sources of energy would seem to be more and more expensive.
Severin Bornstein?
I completely agree with the caller. The getting exact numbers on those issues, of course, is extremely difficult. But even with a modicum of recognition of the pollution externalities from fossil fuels, particularly coal, it would probably bring wind power into an economic pretty much parity. That's probably not going to do it for solar power, for instance, which is extremely expensive still, or some of the other fuel cell and other burgeoning technologies. They, I suspect, in 20 years will become much, much more competitive, but they're still so much more expensive, and I think people are unwilling to recognize, to accept those higher costs. On the international political side of this, I think these are critical issues that we have to recognize. As many people have said, Iraq's role in the world and our position vis-a-vis Iraq certainly is influenced a great deal by the oil economy and the fact that Iraq has huge oil reserves.
And there's not only just Iraq, but a large presence of U.S. military forces in and around the Persian Gulf for quite some numbers of years now.
That's right. As well as our interest in some of the former Soviet states, which probably have political regimes we actually wouldn't be that fond of, but they also have quite a bit of oil.
Seth, thanks for calling and making the point.
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, we appreciate it. Finally, before we move on, there is the issue of nuclear power, which is clean energy, obviously presents a lot of problems, but people, I know there was a big conference at MIT lately, which came out to the conclusion that technologies there have improved.
Yes, nuclear power technologies have improved. The reactors themselves have become, I think, quite safe in operation. I think there's still some important security issues that haven't been entirely addressed. On the environmental side, nuclear power has the attraction that it doesn't cause carbon dioxide emissions that have been linked with global warming, and in that sense might actually be a more environmentally attractive fuel than the fossil fuels. Probably the biggest issue with nuclear power is still the security issue, not just in the production, but in the transportation of spent fuel rods and the storage of those spent fuel rods, which by pretty much all accounts still remains a big hole in our security planning in the United States.
There is another set of proposals to deal specifically with the question of the fragility of the electrical power grid around the country. Joining us now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Montpelier is Dan Riker. He's Executive Vice President of Northern Power Systems. He was an Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. Good of you to be with us.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Now, you're a proponent of something called distributed generation. Can you explain what that is briefly?
Yes. We have a choice that we're facing in this country, particularly in the aftermath of this blackout, and that is either we improve the transmission of electricity to utility customers by upgrading the power lines, or we give those customers the ability to generate their own electricity on site. For many businesses facing electricity outages, the so-called on-site generation or distributed generation is a faster and in some cases cheaper alternative than waiting for improvements to the main utility grid. We need to do both. We need to upgrade the power lines in this country, but increasingly, as a result of technology improvements, businesses and homeowners have the choice to generate power on site.
And I know one of the advantages that people have been writing and talking about since the blackout is if you have your own power generation on site, you may not have to worry if the grid goes down.
Absolutely. We've been building these systems at Northern Power for various companies around the United States. Just to give you a quick example, a bottling plant north of San Francisco, an on-site generating facility making both electricity and heat. And in some recent power problems they had there, they rode right through these feeling no impacts whatsoever. And this is where office building companies, industries, a variety of business owners are increasingly headed, which is to generate on-site. It doesn't mean that they completely disconnect from the utility grid. They stay connected to the grid. They draw some of their power, in some cases, from the grid. But in the event of a major problem on the main utility grid, the business can almost instantaneously disconnect and keep the computers running and other critical functions. This is not simply popping on an old backup diesel generator. These power systems run full-time, very cleanly, and in many situations, particularly in high-cost areas like California and New York, they can actually be brought in more cheaply than buying grid-supplied electricity.
We're speaking with Dan Riker and Severin Borenstein about the price of power. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call. This is Anne, who's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I have a question about efficiency. My understanding was that we deregulated and turned public utilities over to corporations because we thought they could run them more efficiently, but now that's sort of coming into question. And my question is about whether it wouldn't be more efficient, as Dan says, to have more local control, where local people could choose alternatives, have more choices, and where the public utilities would be more accountable to the people that they're serving. So I'd be interested to hear his comments on that.
We're going to ask him to keep it brief, since this was the subject of the program largely yesterday, but you obviously called in today, so let's get an answer.
Well, actually, an increasing number of utilities are seeing it in their interest to support distributed generation. It actually can help them avoid having to upgrade expensive transmission and distribution lines. So my hope is that as we go forward, the utilities are actually going to support this move to on-site power.
And thanks very much. We appreciate it. We know everybody can't listen every day, but do your best, okay? Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. The idea of generating your own electricity is not a new one, and I wanted to bring Severin Borenstein into the conversation on this as well. In the early 1900s, railroads, steel producers, a lot of businesses generated their own electricity before it became cheaper to hook up to the nation's grid. They were defeated, I guess, or decided to switch because of efficiencies of scale. Has anything changed since then?
Well, the technologies have obviously changed quite a bit, and some of the distributed generation technology is rather efficient. Overall, though, the comparison you have to really make is between the cost of on-site generation and the cost of central generation alone. So, for instance, comparing the cost of on-site generation to California's retail electricity prices is really not a fair comparison, because some of that is paying for the well-known costs from 2 years ago. So simply going off that power in order to generate your own doesn't eliminate those costs. It just shifts them to someone else. Mm-hmm. When you do the comparison of on-site generation to the similar new technologies for central station generation, the central station generation still wins in almost every case. They are getting closer on-site. I think the real arguments for on-site generation are more as a cooperative or backup in case of blackouts. And as Dan mentioned, as in producing other outputs at the same time, what's often called combined heat and power production, generation on-site that also produce waste heat that can then be used to heat the building or in other ways, that can be tremendously efficient in some installations.
Dan, we've got 30 seconds for you in this segment.
Well, the key issue is to factor in the cost of lost production. An IBM plant in New York State just last week lost $300 million worth of production, and an on-site generating system probably would have made a lot of economic sense for that plant.
We're talking about alternatives to the country's apparently overloaded electrical system and to our apparently insatiable appetite for power. All of this in the wake of last week's power outage that struck much of the Northeast, parts of Canada, and, of course, parts of the Midwest, too. If you have questions, you can call us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or zap us an email using your juiced-up computer or your battery-powered laptop, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're discussing alternative energy sources. If you'd like to join that conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Our guests are Severin Borenstein, director of the Energy Institute at the University of California at Berkeley, and Dan Riker, a former assistant secretary of energy in the Clinton administration, now a managing partner of New Energy Capital. And Dan Riker, before we get to some calls about some other alternative energy sources we haven't discussed, I wanted to ask more about the distributive power system that you're investing in and that you're hoping to promote. What kind of generators do you have? Is it diesel power?
Well, it's called the microgrid, and essentially, Neil, it's similar to this evolution we made from mainframe computers to personal computers, then all those got networked together via the Internet. We are making something of a similar transition from big power plants to small power plants, and we're figuring out how to put those together, and that's the microgrid. You might put a series of generating units, engines, turbines, solar panels, storage devices in a shopping center, on a university campus, in an office park. The one we're building here in Vermont is indeed at an office park with some surrounding homes. So you disperse these little generating units of various sorts. You hook them together to maximize their efficiency and minimize their cost. And then you hook the whole microgrid to the main utility grid. And so that you can get some of the power from the main grid, some of the power from the microgrid. The key, though, is when the main grid gets into trouble, the microgrid can almost instantaneously disconnect and keep this entire complex of businesses or offices moving.
And I wonder if you've had a surge of interest in investment in the past week.
Absolutely. Businesses of all sort who felt some very serious impacts on their bottom line and their ability just to function have been expressing great interest in distributed generation generally and this concept of the microgrid in particular. We're at a demonstration phase, hooking all of these distributed units together in a microgrid, but we are really at the here and now with the general use of distributed generation. There's a number of large companies. One of the largest office building companies in the United States now has 12 of their office towers in various cities relying on-site generation to power most of the building.
Let's get some listeners involved, and let's go to Will, who's with us from Dublin, California.
How you doing?
Okay.
I had read a article on MSN about a month ago, and they were talking about garbage, extracting the oil from garbage and such as old tires and rubber products like that to make a viable source of oil for this country. Is that science fiction, or is that because that'd be a future?
Severin Borenstein, is it Soylent?
Well,
is it Soylent Green?
It's not science fiction, but it's also not the present either. Extracting oil from a number of sources that we haven't traditionally thought of as energy sources has been on the map for more than 20 years now, and most of them are feasible scientifically but aren't very cost competitive. Probably the most cost competitive and coming that is being developed in Canada, where Canada has vast amounts of oil sands from which petroleum can be extracted. In fact, the Canadians claim that they actually have the second largest oil reserve in the world after Saudi Arabia, if you count their oil sands correctly. That is probably cost competitive at $30 or $40 a barrel, they're arguing. But some of these other sources, such as extracting oil from petroleum-based products that have been built, probably are much more expensive.
Thanks for the question, Will.
Thanks a lot.
Email question from Art Giannicelli. What is the progress of tidal power?
Tidal power is being investigated in many places. It's, again, a very attractive source. When you first think about it, there's a lot of energy in tides. If you can capture that energy and turn it into electricity, it could be a source of power. Of course, it will also have environmental implications for when you put these generators into the ocean. But as of now, it's certainly not something people are considering a major cost competitive source of energy, but it's something, again, that we should be continuing to invest in research on so that we can, 20 years from now, potentially use these as major sources of energy.
Mm-hmm. Dan Riker, you can add your voice in, too, as a former Assistant Secretary of Energy. You know about these things, as well as Severin Borenstein.
Well, let me say that there's really two aspects to the cost. One is we do have to continue to invest in R&D and bring the costs of these various technologies down. The good news is that several of them are quite competitive. As we heard earlier, wind is quite competitive. Cogeneration using engines or turbines, which gets very high efficiency, is cost competitive today in a variety of applications. The other aspect, though, that's important to understand is that we can bring the cost of these units down, but frankly, the investment community has yet to fully understand the investment opportunities in building projects. So we need to invest in the technology, but we also need to put together large amounts of capital to get actual projects built. New Energy Capital, which I'm a member of, is a new project investment fund that we are putting together to do that, trying to raise capital, get the investment community interested in investing, and begin to make money from producing power in a more distributed manner. and cleaner sort of way.
An email note from Aleem in Santa Monica, California. Your guest said earlier many people have a not-in-my-backyard response to wind farms. I have quite a different response. Every time I drive between San Francisco and Los Angeles, I admire amazing sights. One is the Pacific Coast, as seen from Route 1. The other, though, are the hundreds of elegant windmills that fill the brown and golden rolling hills just outside of the San Francisco area. They always strike me as a beautiful and serene work of mass sculpture. I wish I lived closer to them. So not everybody sees them as eyesores.
You know, I'd have to say, this is Dan Riker, that my experience, having looked at wind projects all over the country and all over the world, particularly as assistant secretary, is that people who gain experience with wind farms, live near them, tend to really end up liking them. There was a big controversy here in Vermont over the first commercial wind farm east of the Mississippi that was built here in 1997. The real estate agents around there actually will tell you that people, when renting their ski homes, ask for views of the wind farms. So they actually can be beautiful objects on the landscape. They move, I think the more experienced people have, the better off they're accepted.
Let's get one last question from John, who's with us in Cleveland.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
Really appreciate the topic. I just wanted to mention that I'd had the opportunity to travel through Scandinavia last summer and notice all the wind machines that they had along the seacoast. And I traveled through France this summer and saw a lot of nuclear. And just wondered, what's happened to the progressive feeling in the country and if we should not use Europe as a pretty good model for alternative energy sources.
Severin Borenstein?
Well, there is resistance to both, as we've been talking about, nuclear power and wind. Europe certainly has, France particularly, invested very heavily in nuclear power, and I think the French would argue fairly successfully. They do face the same sort of waste disposal problems that we face. It is interesting that the sociology of different countries affects the way and the extent to which people are willing to accept these risks and these eyesores or at least visual pollution that some people argue against.
Let me add that Denmark now gets 20% of its electricity roughly from wind, and they have built a major, major industry around exporting wind turbines all over the world. So that this is not just a way to get cleaner energy, but it's actually a way to have some very serious positive impacts on a nation's economy.
John, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Europe also teaches us some lessons about the pricing of electricity. Europe has, particularly for the French, have pioneered time-varying prices of electricity so that in France, during the daytime, electricity costs more than at night. Something that has been really resisted in the United States and is gradually catching on, the whole area of demand response as part of the electricity situation has, we haven't really touched on today, but it's probably an important part of thinking about how the electricity grid and the system can be made more stable. When we get into a tight situation and the demand for power goes up, one thing that would help a lot is if we were in a position to have some customers, for instance, turn off the air conditioning for 10 minutes, which can be done even remotely. There are pilot programs to do it remotely from the utility, just to cycle off air conditioners.
John, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And I'd like to thank both of our guests, Severin Borenstein, who you just heard, director of the Energy Institute and professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, with us from the studio on the campus there. We appreciate your time, as always.
Thanks for having me on.
And Dan Riker, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dan Riker is Executive Vice President of Northern Power Systems, formerly Assistant Secretary of Energy during the Clinton administration. He joined us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Montpelier. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.